Hi, I'm Hilary Yerbury, and Jill said that my starting point was 11:25, and it's a bit after 11:25, so I guess to make sure that I run reasonably to time and leave space for the person who's coming after me, I probably need to get started. So thank you very much for being here. We've been talking a lot about community in the last couple of days, and my original starting point for a larger research project was when we talk about community, what do we mean by it? So unlike most of the other presentations which we've had at the conference, mine really is a research project which flags some implications for organisations, but actually doesn't go down the path of talking about what those organisations can or should do. So community has traditionally been seen to exist around a place, and we've just heard Darren talking about place, where people have a sense of belonging, where they're acknowledged, where they have a role to play in the life of the collective, and where they share values and principles. The influences of thoughts from the earliest days of sociology have been persistent and far-reaching. Some of you will remember how Durkheim emphasised the importance of solidarity, placing social relations at the heart of community. Weber had that focus on social action and the relationships which allow those actions to occur. And Tonyes made that distinction between what he called, well, in German, of course, Gemeinschaft and Gesellschaft, where the first is a kind of living natural organism and the second is artificial, created, where individuals are brought together to achieve something in the notion of an association. And if we look at the way that we think about community, we can see evidence of each of those. And each of them places community very much in the public eye. So that's the conspicuous community of the title. Now, Barry Wellman, whose extensive work on social networking and the use of the internet has influenced a great number of recent studies, has indicated that the use of the internet has changed the way that we think about community and the way that we live and experience community. And he says that community through the internet appears to have been, in his words, privatized. He says it's become hidden indoors rather than visibly outdoors. And so in the title of the paper, this is the inconspicuous community, the notion of community that's been brought indoors. So the questions that I'm looking at today are how is community conspicuous and inconspicuous, and what are some of the implications for actions in civil society? So let me now briefly introduce the study and the participants. So this is part of a larger study of members of Generation X and Generation Y who are active in civil society online. And I collected the data in 2007. And I say that because in terms of some of the advances in the field, 2007 was might as well have been in the 18th century. It's an ethnographic study based on a whole range of different types of data collection, and I used the snowball technique to try to get a wide variety of people involved. So I had a range of starting points. What I found was that there was a great deal of crossover in both the people, their interactions with civil society, and so on and so forth. I don't know whether you're interested in their characteristics, so I'll just say very briefly that there were 15 from Generation X and 9 from Generation Y, and I use the ABS definition for Generation X, which gives me a cut-off point at 1981, and that's actually really convenient for the sample because they fell into basically those over 25 and those under 22. 15 males and 9 females, 16 in the workforce and 8 still students. Because we were looking at their involvement in social actions, they identified 28 online sites. That wasn't the complete number. Those were the ones that came up in the stories that they told. And there were 11 sites which were common to 2 or more participants. And so I've tried to give you some feeling for those there. And Darren might be interested to know that GetUp was the most referred to site, followed by Oxfam. Actually, those two both outranked Facebook and YouTube in the stories that the young people told. The participants in this study are educated, so they're not the marginalised youth that some people have been concerned in talking about. So they're young people with undergraduate degrees, studying for honours, doing higher degrees of various kinds, and they're young people who are interested in knowing about the world around them. So in passing, they refer to Habermas and Seligman, to Putnam, to Beck, to Henrik Bang, as though they're people that they know. Okay. So, conspicuous community. What is it? How do they live it? How do they experience it? They are very obviously involved in creating and maintaining community in an open and public way. They take part in instrumental actions. They follow the rational, logical approach. They make a commitment to do things over time, to pursue objectives that are shared with others. So the kinds of actions that happen very much in the public view, that happen outdoors, to use Wellman's phrase. Community in this context, for most of them, most of the time, is based around embodied collective action. Although one of the interesting things is that there's often a paradox for them in their reactions to these notions of conspicuous community. Volunteering is important to all of these young people. So these don't match that so often heard phrase that young people are apathetic. These young people aren't apathetic. They've all taken part in things, whether it's as part of the University Students Association or through organisations such as ANTAR or through their local bush care group. And they engage emotionally as well as rationally in this. So Anna told me that she was really excited when she gets emails from GetUp and is invited to go to meetings. She gets a great deal of satisfaction out of this because she meets other people and shares her interests. And she feels that she's part of something. Now, she knows that this is paradoxical because she knows full well that she's one of, 100,000 other people who get the email, but she feels an emotional attachment to this. So that's one of the paradoxes. David, on the other hand, sounds really wistful when he says he doesn't belong to any organisations in civil society, and so therefore he probably isn't part of the citizenry, and he feels quite sad about that. Most of the volunteering then happens because people see themselves as members of associations. But Catherine's Bush Care group, she tells me, isn't actually an association. It's a loosely coordinated group of people with similar interests who are interested in a particular part of Sydney and restoring the bush in that area. So they're working to that shared end, and they just happen to have decided that they'll get together from a community notice board the first Sunday of the month at 11 o'clock. How do they know that? Because there's a notice on the telegraph pole, which is just at the entrance to the place where you go down to the bush. So they are conspicuous on the days when they're working together on this bush regeneration project, and completely inconspicuous the rest of the time, whereas Antar, for example, has a continuing associational presence and is conspicuous through its website and its mailing address. When a structure for trying to achieve an objective doesn't exist, these young people are quite happy to go out there and establish a group or formalise a structure to do it. Aimé has discussed how in a project for youth development and conflict resolution that he's involved in, it's been really important for them to establish what he called a bureaucratized structure to ensure that the leadership, the planning and action are agreed and also open to scrutiny. He says you can't have conflict resolution unless your own practices are open to scrutiny. Robert and Marianne each emphasise the importance of having rules and guidelines. They work as moderators in discussion forums, but they have differing views. Robert's view is that the guidelines aren't collaboratively set, and this is a weakness for his community, whereas Marianne's view is that actually the guidelines need to be set outside, because that, for her, is the way that you get healthy boundaries within the community. That's a quote from her. Exchanging information, as you would all know, is a key part of establishing community, and it's also very much something that's conspicuous. Now, the second picture down actually comes from Amnesty International, and that's a getting together group, getting together to discuss cases and share information. Annette sees herself as a connector in this kind of context. Alan is involved with music and community theatre, and he says that the theatre scene in Australia is very small, so that the internet actually allows him to tap into ideas and innovations from overseas and bring them back into his community. So here, again, you can see that paradox, the needing to go out to come back into the embodied community. Catherine insists that exchanging information only gives you a sense of community when you actually have a person who's attached to that information. Otherwise, she sees it as a transaction, and she's one of those people who's very concerned about transactionalism and being commodified. You know, she is not at all into non-human actors in the exchange of information. And so she says that she can only feel a connection with the person who posted the information if she can say something like, "Ah, yes, that's the girl with red hair. And now I can associate that information with an individual." Whereas Sunil, on the other hand, he's one of those people like Robin was talking about yesterday. He posts on Wikipedia. He says he doesn't need emotional engagement. Intellectual challenge is what's important for him. So taking part in collective action is also often evidence of community. Because Anna mentioned it, I've got the get up walk against warming, and actually that's a plug for Darren, because yesterday when I was talking to him, he was beginning to send out emails, I think, to encourage people to take part in the walk against warming. So this is trying to bring into the embodied realm something which otherwise is inconspicuous. A petition used to be seen as the equivalent of a march. you know, people were actually putting themselves into the action. So both actually used to require, in a way still do, require the individual to identify themselves. So in an embodied sense, in the case of the walk, and through giving their name and contact details in the case of the petition. But Tristan, in my study, drew a really significant distinction between signing a petition online and taking part in a march. He says that he knows that he can do things online because he's a number. He says, I can do things online because I'm a number, so I'll sign the petitions online. But as soon as I can be photographed, identified, that's where I draw the line. If activities where I can be photographed jeopardize my future, then I don't know how valuable they are right now. Now, for those of you who are in Sydney, you might be interested to know that this was in the context of, or at the time of, the APEC security measures in Sydney, where we had cameras and microphones on, you know, every third lamppost, which meant, you know, four times between street corners, and there was a lot of concern about being conspicuous when actually you just wanted to go about your daily business. Taking part in discussions can be an essential part of creating community, going beyond the exchange of information to create new understandings. And here we've got similarities with Habermas's notion of the public sphere, which several of the participants referred to. Alistair takes the written word for granted, and he values what he calls rational, coherent argument. But Ben isn't convinced that rational argument creates community. And he says that for him, it's sometimes impossible to understand what makes people coalesce. He says that for him online, it seems to be based on little winks and nudges. Impossible for me to read clues. And then he goes on to liken some of these interactions to, quote, public sex and drug deals, where the kind of communication that people have would probably be invisible to me because I don't do those things. So that notion of things which are conspicuous to some and inconspicuous to others. Conspicuous community, we've talked a little bit about social action, and Kelly has been very keen to establish ways for people to share others' social actions, and you can see some of those at the bottom of the screen. What's interesting, I think, about the social action is that it's both conspicuous and inconspicuous. Bauman has a phrase for this, and he calls it individualistic altruism, where we start with the individual. We put ourselves at the centre, what's important for us, and then only secondarily do we think about the impact of that on other people, making changes in the circumstances of other people. So, inconspicuous community. So as I said earlier, for Wellman, community becomes inconspicuous when it moves indoors. For him, when it's created or enacted online. For me, Jonathan kind of established this distinction. He said that being online is different to the street, where you can see someone walking down the street. There's a kind of visibility that you have in an offline community. It's harder in the city, he says, being somebody who comes from the country and where everybody knew everybody. It's harder in the city, but up to a point there's still that element of visibility that there isn't in an online community. So it's perhaps that lack of visibility that enabled Tristan, that I mentioned earlier, to engage in online petitions. So he's taken the outdoors, you know, that public action indoors, making that public act into a private act. And as we've heard from others, you know, the internet, mobile phones and so on and so forth allow individuals to maintain contact both privately and publicly. In the context of this study, I've already said that the participants were all educated, but actually they all also intellectualise their actions and activities. So they are really brought together, they feel, by the articles that they've read. I mentioned that they can talk about Habermas or Beck, you know, as though that person might be an uncle or, you know, a friend of the family. And it's not that they're brought together because they've all studied the same things. They haven't. So I think that we've got something else going on there amongst a particular type, perhaps, of young people. The imagined communities also form around organisational symbolism, and I've put there the Antar hand from the Sea of Hands that some of you might be familiar with. Because we can be aware that those people who have signed a hand for the Sea of Hands all feel linked to the other, you know, several hundred thousand people who've also signed the Sea of Hands. So that's another example of inconspicuous community. Inconspicuous too, when people don't know each other and relations. The participants in my study tell me can form in those circumstances. Robert and Isaac actually belong to a community where participants are anonymous, deliberately anonymous. Isaac has one view on it, Robert has a different view. Isaac says, one would think that anonymous postings don't actually lead to community, but really they do. He explains how for him there's a shared intellectual effort, and in this instance, adopting anonymity is kind of like saying I'm selfless, so I contribute to this community without having to take any credit from it. Robert, on the other hand, doesn't think that anonymous postings lead to community, although they're part of the same group. He says that for him, anybody is anonymous. So instead of you expecting different people in anonymous, you just treat anonymous as an entity, as a whole, as one single person. So we can see there that even young people who know each other and share experiences aren't necessarily going to see the same thing in the same way. And we know that, but for me it was really interesting to hear such stark distinctions. They both, however, do think that they can create community through their discussions. Isaac is one of those people who talks about Habermas as though that might be a friend of the family. And he is very keen on this notion of the public sphere, and he says that he thinks that now he's talking to me, you might be a bit optimistic to think that the musings of a few immature college students is the basis of democratic groundwork. So he's aware of taking an idea and then the limitations of those ideas. Community isn't just inconspicuous because action takes place indoors or because communication acts a part of an imagined community. As other speakers have said, community also exists because it exists around the intangibles, those intangibles of trust, credibility, friendship, and so on. And whilst I could spend a lot of time talking about that, I'll just pick up again from Isaac, who says that the important thing is that you can recognise that other people are authentic, and it's because you recognise that they're authentic that you can trust them, but you don't have to agree with them. He says people don't have to have a unified set of morals or ethics. So, finally, friendship. And I'll just mention the insurance policy. Friendship is important to most of these young people as the basis from which they can take other actions. Catherine talks about the inconspicuous community of friendship as an insurance policy. Because she's got friends who are going to support her, she can actually go out there and take action. She can do things because she's got other people who will help her when maybe it doesn't quite turn out in the way that she wants it to turn out or that she hopes that it's going to turn out. So there's considerable emphasis from these young people on creating community, whether it's conspicuous or inconspicuous. They spend a lot of time talking about what they do and how they do it, the strategies that they use, how they engage in discussion, how they share information, how they plan, how they take actions, and so on and so forth. They're all very keen to make a difference in the world, both to the world in general and to the world where they live. You know, the part, the bit that they're part of. We can see a distinction, a similarity with Anthony Giddens and his notion of political actions. So he says that there are people who are interested in overcoming injustice and exploitation and inequality, and he talks about those people, whom he sees as mainly baby boomers, as engaging in emancipatory politics. And he says that people from Generation X, because he wrote in 1990, are more likely to be concerned with what he called lifestyle politics. That is, choosing to take actions which improve the world that you are going to be part of, that make the world more the kind of place where you want to live. We can see a similarity with, here with Ulrich Beck, again, that a number of the participants referred to. But Beck goes further when he says that the generation that he calls freedom's children practice a seeking, experimenting morality that ties things together that seem mutually exclusive, that ties together egoism and altruism, self-realization and active compassion, where self-realization becomes active compassion. So when these young people are involved in what they call community, they don't think about the same concept. They're not really even thinking about a single concept. They're beginning to cluster concepts. And what I've tried to do here is to show the concepts that you can find in their way of talking about community. And I think the thing that's important for us here to think about is that each of these concepts acts as a referent for the others, so that civil society becomes a referent for community, but also a referent for social action. Social action is a referent for community, but also for social relations. Social relations is related to community, but is also a referent for identity. And all of these are influenced by by the ICTs available and the way in which they're used. So I might just come back there. So community is out there for the participants in this study, in civil society, in social action, and in social relations. But it's in here, in social relations and identity and social capital. It's found in solidarity, like Durkheim said. It's found in social action, like Weber said, and it's very much in those shared interests, what Tonius called the community of the mind. It's not something which these young people think is lost. They're not nostalgic for it. They're out there making it and remaking it, working it and reworking it all of the time. So I think that before I come to the conclusion, I should just say something about identity and the way in which construction of identity is important to that notion of community. Because it's here where we see that the public and the private collide. Aimé is very interested in his own personal growth and development, but he recognises that in order for that to happen as a personal thing, he has to be out there, staying informed and, in his words, staying active and keeping alive. So for him, he has to be involved in information exchange. Alistair identifies himself as a political activist, and he identifies himself as a writer who values humour and satire. He also several times refers to himself as a pedant, and he told me a place where he blogs, and so I can tell you that there are others who actually have called him a notorious pedant. Now, he constructs his identity through writing, blogging, and discussion. But in order to be that internal person, he has to be out there as well. Robert is in that process of turning from a boy to a man. He would have been 20 when he and I had our discussions and so on. He wants people to look up to him. And so he tries to act as a leader in his communities. That means that he acts as a moderator in discussion forums. He uses a pseudonym in another discussion forum because he wants to explore questions of masculinity. Alan and Tristan recognize that as students, they're still testing out their opinions and perspectives, and they don't want to be held responsible in the future for the actions of the present. And so they do their best to be themselves, but not to leave traces of themselves. One of the things that Tristan said was that he sees himself as a very rational being, and he's not going to take part in collective action, not only because of those cameras on the street corners, but also because collective action for him is a kind of irrational, emotionally based argument. Now, I wonder whether he's read something around social action theory social movement theory and got hold of one part of the picture and not the rest. So, implications of all of this for community organisations. I actually changed the slide that I had to come next because when I was in Penny Hagen's keynote yesterday, I thought that Penny actually had those eloquent and evocative phrases. Organisations need to be reaching out, and they also need to be moving closer. I will not talk any more about that because I'm sure that many of you are familiar with those ideas. But what I do want to say is that as organisations do go through that reaching out and moving closer, we have to think about some of the elements of expectations which we are perhaps not managing in those contexts. So there are lots of opportunities there for engaging in conspicuous community. But if we think about it, there are relatively few for young people to actually develop their knowledge, their growth and development and their skills within the community. There are relatively few opportunities for recognition beyond the peer recognition. There are relatively few opportunities for renewal, updating and change because, as many of us have discussed over the food outside, once we've got our organisations to make a decision about something, organisations are about stability and we really want to be able to hang on to that for quite a while. And the moving closer. So lots of opportunities for moving closer, whereas for the reaching out there was and or but. Here I think there's more but. There are lots of opportunities beginning to emerge for engaging in inconspicuous communities, especially through that notion of what Isaac called the sharing of moral principles. These young people want to be able to lurk because they want to be able to gain confidence. Sometimes they want to be able to remain anonymous because they're still developing their identities. There are opportunities for that, but it's often very difficult for them in wider open communities, that is, to find the emotional engagement that young people like Catherine thinks is absolutely essential to building community, or to find the intellectual development that is essential to so many of them. So I'll leave us with three challenges that inconspicuous community leaves us with. So the challenge to establish shared understandings, and again, the things that's come up in many of the presentations, the fact that we, in an organisational sense, often want to maintain control over the message. These young people want to get out there and take that message and do their own thing with it. The challenge to the rational, logical approach, the importance of emotional engagement and how we find that. And finally, I think significantly, the challenge to the public collective nature of action that underpins so much of what we know and see and do. So the coexistence of the public world and the private world, the individual and the collective, of egoism and altruism, as Beck said, and that constant demand for renewal and for choice. So thank you very much. And I think I've left us with probably 1.5 minutes for questions.
Thanks for a fascinating paper. I must say that I'm not absolutely clear whether you're suggesting that there is a breakdown of the barriers between the conspicuous and the inconspicuous communities. And if you are, whether or not you're attributing some of that to the power of information communications technology.
I think what I'm saying is that the language of the question is probably not language that that I would have chosen in terms of breakdown. I think it's certainly true that to say that community for this particular group of young people is both conspicuous and inconspicuous, and that to a large extent the inconspicuous is very important to them. Is it because of information technologies? I would not have thought of it in that way, and I think that they don't think about it in that way. I think that many of them are of the generation where, as they say, they've grown up with the computer, they've grown up with the mobile phone. It allows them to keep in touch. It allows them to do a range of things in their own way. There was some mention yesterday of people doing things in private, you know, without their parents getting to know about things. And I think that isn't this something that we've all been able to do in ways in the past? So I think that ICTs is a part of the mix. I don't think it's necessarily the reason for the mix. From the basis of the 24 young people I spoke to here, one has to say those things. And I'm, yeah.
I wondered about this very background of the 24 young people. You would assume perhaps if they were social workers or studying politics, they may be more inclined to social action, but not, for example.
No social workers. Studies from sociology to computing science, media studies, economics, commerce, law.
No
scientist, one engineer. Okay, thank you all very much. I should hand over now to Kirsty.